This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to Scran, the podcast passionate about the Scottish food and drink scene. I'm your host, Rosalind Erskine, and on this episode, I take a trip to the Isle of Skye. When I visited Skye, I was lucky enough to meet producers and people working in various food and drinks businesses across the island. First stop was the Isle of Skye Sea Salt Company, where I met Mina and Chris Watts, who, having moved to Skye from London, were determined to set up a long-term sustainable business.
We knew that whatever we got involved with would have to be very sustainable in its makeup, because that underlies our own beliefs and values.
The Three Chimneys, one of Skye's most popular restaurants and guest houses, was my next stop, where I caught up with head chef Scott Davis. His enthusiasm for the amazing fresh produce available to him was really great, and I promise you this interview will make you hungry.
Yeah, it's a really bountiful place, and that's really drives our menu. We get some beautiful seaweed from up the Thurso, up in the north of Scotland as well. So yeah, it's quite an amazing how much produce. We're right in the heart of amazing larder in Scotland.
I also paid a visit to Isle of Skye Free Range, where I met Glynis and Alistair McLean, who can normally be found working their croft to produce quality free-range poultry and meat products for the local market.
So this is a little business opportunity. So I started with just a few chickens. Yeah, so that was 10 years ago. And then decided we had some good lamb, some good beef. We rear Shetland beef, Shetland cows, and they're a smaller cow. Very suited for this climate, actually, because they don't poach the ground too much.
The final stop on my tour was the pier in Dunvegan, where I met local fisherman Kevin McKinnon of Loch Dunvegan Shellfish, who told me how fishing is something you'll fall in love with despite the demanding conditions and variable weather. I am now joined by Mina and Chris Watts, founders of the Isle of Skye Sea Salt Company. So if you could just sort of take me to the beginning of the company, how did it all kind of come about?
We moved to Skye over 15 years ago, and we came with many years of experience. When we came to Skye, we came without any expectations about what we were going to do, because we knew we had a range of experience and we didn't want to come with fixed ideas. And when we settled here, we actually built an eco home, and then we decided we did need to earn some more income. So we knew that whatever we got involved with would have to be very sustainable in its makeup, because that underlies our own beliefs and values. And so I'll pass you over to Chris for how the sea salt came.
Yes, well, we were having different ideas that we thought we might take up. And then the idea of sea salt came up. One day I was looking up the loch from the house and thought, well, there's plenty of raw material. It's not going to disappear. And maybe sea salt would be a good idea. It's nothing more than an intuition, really. Somehow it sounded right for the Isle of Skye. So we started doing lots of research into different things and different aspects, the way it was made here in the UK, none of which particularly appealed, because we wanted something that was very natural. So in the end, we transported a hot, dry climate process to the Isle of Skye. Yes, everyone laughs when we say that. The idea was to use solar evaporation. So in order to do that, we had to find a way where that might work. And so we looked at polytunnels and putting ponds inside polytunnels. The sun generates enough heat inside the polytunnel to evaporate the water, and then the wind blows through the polytunnel and clears the saturated air so that the stage cycle continues right down to when we form the crystals. So we call it a single stage evaporation, so that everything that's in the sea, all the minerals and compounds which compose the seawater, are actually in the crystals as well. So it's a very natural product.
When Chris says we, actually it was Chris who was the geek at the beginning, and he actually did 2 years of research on how we might be able to have a process here on Skye that really was sustainable. We had no textbooks to follow, and we actually, you know, reflecting back on that, we're really pleased that we didn't follow anybody else. We actually developed our own process, and we knew that because of what we had done before, that the best way to go forward was not to sort of start something and halfway through sort of say, oh, we'll now introduce sustainable and eco features to this. We actually wanted to do that right from the word go. So now, we, as we say, with our sea salt, it's sustainable from lock to larder.
And how long ago was that?
We went into production in 2013 with one pond. So these are commercial polytunnel size, so about 90 feet by 20 feet. And then the following year, we added another pond. The following year, we added a drying tunnel for drying the salt naturally. Then a third pond the year after that. So 2017, we got to full production. 4 years later.
And what made you come to Skye from Yorkshire? Was it just like something you always wanted to do?
No, our base was, Chris was actually born, that's what he was born right. in Yorkshire. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, a very long time ago.
Our base was actually in London. Right. So what happened was we were actually working in Papua New Guinea, managing the then largest voluntary service overseas programme of 90 projects, which is huge. We used to do a lot of walking and camping in years gone by. And it was in Papua New Guinea that we realised that back home, we had never got as far as Scotland with our walking, partly because we had some lovely Scottish people working with us, you know, on projects there. When we came back, we every year from our London base, we'd have a holiday on and walk, you know, up the western sort of highlands. And then 1 year we came to Skye because there was a bridge and wasn't really any planning. And it was just, there was something about the location and Skye that just, I think it just sort of really got into our souls. Yeah. We knew that we wanted to move here to that particular location especially. And we had the opportunity to do that and really consider this very much as home and absolutely love it.
So you don't miss London?
No. No, I think, to be fair, I think, you know, we it's been lovely exploring the cities of Glasgow and Edinburgh as well. It's nice to have the city breaks in the past, you know, before COVID. And London's a great city. Not gonna play it down. We loved our life there. We always worked hard and we really enjoyed the range of cultural aspects there. We're very much entrenched to the Scottish way of life. One of the things I've loved, I was asked to be chair of Skye Dance in years gone, but when I first came, because dancing's my other, I love it as a, you know, as a hobby. And then I got asked to be director of the Arros Community Theatre. And it was just lovely to be, you know, to make an input into both of those organisations and others. And I think one of the things that I really love about being here is there are lots of similarities between the Scottish culture and the Indian culture. That thing about families coming together and eating and drinking and singing and laughing and having a blather, you know, it's lovely.
Back to the salt, so it's very much of its place. Do you find over the course of the time you've been doing this that the food and drink industry drives tourism? So do you find people come to visit you when they're visiting Skye just to sort of pick up a bit of local produce?
We don't really do a lot of tours. If people find us, then we're happy to sort of talk to them and take them through the process. But you know, we've deliberately got ourselves out at a fairly remote location on the Loch Snizort. So we're not really geared up for visits and things like that. So, but the tourism industry has been very important to us in people buying our product. We are sold right across the island and across the Highlands.
We were very aware strategically, you know, if we're talking about how we were going to go forward, there was the sustainable aspects. We also wanted to really promote the Isle of Skye brand. That's what we started doing very, you know, all those years ago, and lots of other producers have taken that up. And what happens is, in the past, people have come from all over the world. And we've also been really thankful for the support that we've had from, you know, in terms of grants, the odd grant that we've got from Highland Enterprise and others. And, you know, for a small business, things like that are just so important because it is really hard work. We're established and as a company, and it can come across as quite glamorous, but it's been really hard work. And we're really proud to have been part of that Scottish food and drink industry, actually.
We've had great support from the businesses on Skye as well. Three Chimneys has supported us from day one, and the other restaurants across Skye as well. So we're very lucky in that way. And we work with a number of producers as well across Scotland. So Graham's Butter, Isle of Skye Sea Salt Butter, and with Cocoa Chocolate in Edinburgh, Chocolates of Glenshiel, and a number of other chocolatiers.
And this sort of natural sea salt is becoming quite a thing, isn't it, with Blackthorn and then these new... It's quite nice to see, because obviously customers are going, and we want something more natural than what was your table salt, is that?
Yeah, they are. It's people who love food and sort of want to know how things are made are interested in foods like the sea salt. We were actually invited to the first salt symposium, sea salt symposium in Barora a couple of months ago now, actually. Yeah. They had a lot of archaeologists talking about how salt used to be made in Scotland, and we were asked to talk on a sustainable process. And then when we were actually introduced as pioneers of the sea salt industry in Scotland, because of course it hasn't really, as a business, happened for hundreds of years to be sort of presented as people who kind of kick-started the salt industry. Felt like it was quite a nice feeling, wasn't it?
I think the other thing is that we're all different as well, and we all make our salt differently. We were the first in the UK to do the solar evaporation process, and we're still the only one in Scotland doing that. And it produces different salts, so the nature of the salt and the taste of the salt and the texture of the salt is different from each producer. So people do have a real choice of buying Scottish sea salt rather than just looking to England or to Europe or further afield.
And would you say, is it more the process that influences the taste rather than the location?
I think it's both. It's that mix of provenance and process. We have a very slow natural process. We only make the salt April to September because we don't have any power on site. It's just the sun and the wind. That long process and, you know, the type of water that you're using, very clean waters around Skye, means that you've got a very pure product, and that's reflected in the taste and the texture of the crystals that give a different texture, say, to the flakes that you commonly get from the more industrial process.
So how do you just get the water from the loch and just leave it, and it's just the sun and the wind that just breaks it down into the salt, is that right? So you just go and take out the water.
Yeah, we pump the water out of the loch into the ponds.
Right,
And then we leave it to naturally evaporate, literally. So it could take 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 3 weeks. Really depends on the sun and the wind, because you need the wind going through the polytunnels to clear the saturated air. So, yeah, I mean, sun and wind together, which luckily we do get quite a lot of wind. and sometimes we get quite a lot of sun. So it does work, obviously. We're still here after nearly 10 years, but it is only April to September.
We're really grateful to the local people, you know, when we first started and even now, because they sort of feel really proud that, you know, we've created something that is on the Isle of Skye, and they've been really supportive, which has been really important to us, but as have all the top chefs. Skye is, you know, good food destination. We've been supported by them, and that's, you know, it's been really fantastic that we've had that support.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Today I'm joined by Scott Davis, the head chef of the Three Chimneys. Hi Scott, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So we're sat here in the restaurant, which is pretty well known, like well renowned across the world. How did you get to this point in your career?
I've worked as a chef for almost 2 decades now. So I worked all over Scotland. In 2013 I was on MasterChef Professionals, and that sort of flagged my name, I think, with the previous owners, Shirley and Eddie. So Shirley gave me a phone call in the beginning of 2015, and we started the interview process then. I loved the idea, I knew the Three Chimneys really well, loved the whole ethos of the business, and I was lucky enough to get the job here and started in June 2015.
And coming in, did you have sort of things that you knew you wanted to do, or were you just kind of sort of picking up where the last chef kind of left off?
When I came to the Three Chimneys, I was quite in awe of the place. Obviously, the connections they made with all the locals, producers, was incredible. So, first of all, when I came here, I was really much finding my feet and then learning the history of the business and the restaurant to make sure I kept in the same ethos of the business. So, very much when I took over from Michael Smith, I cooked his menu for maybe 3 or 4 months, and I started then sort of changing to sort of my style, which is really looking into the history of Scotland, sort of quite Nordic, a lot of curing, pickling, a lot of smoking, a lot of preserving. And then I really phased that in for over a couple of years. So it wasn't really till beginning of 2017 I really started cooking my style of food, very much with in keeping of the Three Chimneys.
So it's very much a like local seasonal produce, working with very closely with local suppliers, is that right?
Yeah, so the Three Chimneys is all, you know, Shirley and Eddie championed this, you know, for, you know, 40 odd years now. And, you know, we've got a very, very good relationship with some great suppliers. Obviously, we've got Lockton Vegan Shellfish, we get prawns, crab, lobsters from. We got Sconce Scallop, which Davy and Ben get some beautiful scallops from. We get mussels on the island, we get Isle of Skye sea salt. We've used Orbost in the past for Iron Age pigs, cattle, beef, sheep. We now use Vatten Farm for lambs and beef. We obviously forage a lot on the islands, get some beautiful sea herbs, wood sorrel, wild garlic, nettles. And then we go to the Outer Hebrides for some beautiful grouse and woodcock from Lewis. We go to Barra for some beautiful snails. And then we go to the mainland then, we use Care No More for fruit wines. So we don't use any European or wines, we use all fruit wines. It's obviously what we used in the past. We get a lot more game then from the mainland. So yeah, it's a really bountiful place, and that's really drives our menu. We get some beautiful seaweed from up the Thurso, up in the north of Scotland as well. So yeah, it's quite an amazing how much produce. We're right in the heart of amazing larder in Scotland.
And do you find throughout your career, I mean, obviously this place has been built on tourism and people coming for the food, but have you found throughout your career that it's become more obvious as people travel, they want to know and they're quite keen to find out more about the food and where it's come from?
I think definitely people with tourism, definitely when they come to the Three Chimneys and come to restaurants now, it's all about produce and provenance, because that's the whole point of coming to that area, is getting that great produce. And obviously, you know, the big topic of the day is obviously carbon footprint as well. And the big impact of hospitality is we make sure that we're using produce in season and as local as we can. And that really, really helps.
What was it like being on MasterChef? Was it, do you think things like that really sort of, people watch it and think, oh, I'd actually quite like to do that as a job?
When I did MasterChef Professionals, it was actually really good for myself personally. I think I was quite a shy individual. I love cooking, but, you know, I never did demos. I was quite in myself and not a great teacher. So when I did that, it really forced me to open up and speak to a lot of people. A lot going on, and that really developed me as a chef and a person. So when I moved on from that, I found it a lot easier to talk to guests, to other chefs, and it just made me a better person.
Did you always want to be a chef? Did you grow up in quite a foodie family, or is this a bit of a step in a different direction for you?
When I was growing up, I was always involved in you know, family teas, baking. It was actually quite funny, my brother was more involved with baking than my mum, and I was less so as the younger child. So it was just a natural, it was something I really loved. I think when I was in school, I really loved cooking. I did a work experience when I was about 15. I went to a local hotel and I absolutely loved it. Loved the vibe, loved the banter in the kitchen. I loved the excitement. And then it was just a natural path then to Caton College. Worked at a local hotel and my career shot through and never looked back.
You're Welsh. So did you stay in Wales or did you want to come to Scotland or did you sort of kind of happen naturally as these things do?
My mum is Scottish. She was born in Glasgow then lived in Inverness. My father's from Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire in West Wales. So they met sailing around the Isles here. They met in Mallaig. Mum lived in Wales for 21 years. So I lived there for 16 years. Mum said, I've had enough of Wales. Lived there for 21 years, wanting to move home. So we came up to Carnoustie and I lived there for 2 years. And I've now been in Scotland for 18 years.
You probably get asked this all the time, but do you have a favourite sort of Scottish produce to cook with?
Oh, Scottish produce is so diverse. There's like a lot of questions get asked if I've got a signature dish, favourite ingredient. I think obviously because we work so much with the seasons, everything changes all the time. One of my favourite birds is probably grouse and woodcock. I absolutely love them. Woodcock's king of the birds. I love scallops. I can't really choose. One of my favourite dishes on the menu at the moment is we make our own haggis using some beautiful offal from Vatton Farm. And we serve that with a cheddar tart, some Talisker whiskey, jus gras, a little whipped crowdy, pickled turnips, and fermented potatoes, which are almost like salt and vinegar potatoes. That's my favourite dish at the moment, but always evolving and always changing.
And if you had any advice for anyone sort of coming into the industry, especially now when things are a bit difficult for staff, what would you say, like, what would be your top tips?
If I was starting my career off from now, I would really look at restaurants or hotels, look at the ethos, look at their menus. I would then go there and then I would eat there first, just to see if I enjoyed the food. And when you're there, you can then speak to the staff and see the vibe. And it's pretty obvious if you're in a happy workplace, because if everybody's smiling and thinking, it makes a big difference. Then I would obviously then talk to the chef and I'd speak to him about, ethos of the business, how the kitchen runs, how many hours you work, what benefits, what training you get, and how much food is actually prepared in-house, which I think is so important. Because obviously the biggest factor in any business is obviously wage costs. So a lot of things in now, unfortunately, in restaurants and hotels is all bought in, pre-packaged, portioned. So it's really important as a young chef that you get to learn all your base skills, from classical French cooking to all your whole butchery, fish prep, shellfish, all your base cookery, and that will set you up in your first couple of years then to move forward quite fast in your career.
And you sound like you're pretty set with your suppliers, but do you kind of add new people in, or kind of, because I'm thinking there's always someone making gin, the Isle of Skye sea salt is relatively new, so like, are you always kind of on the lookout for new businesses popping up?
Yeah, so for new suppliers, I know the best tool at the moment we use is obviously social media. So we keep an eye out on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all these kinds of things. Obviously speak to other chefs in the industry, speak to guests all the time, speak to locals, and there's always keep your ear to the ground, and anything that pops up we tend to use. And we get approached, obviously, with the quality of restaurant we are, we get approached by a lot of new suppliers as well, if we would like to use them as well.
So the last part of the podcast is two sort of questions. One's a quick fire round, one's a general sort of, you might again get asked this all the time, but so if you could only take three whiskies to desert island, what would they be?
The whiskies I would take to a desert island would be Glenfiddich Grand Cron. I had that with Mark Thompson the start of the year. Absolutely, I thought it was phenomenal. Beautiful. I love Jura 10-year-old. It's sort of my go-to whiskey. I just find it really easy to drink, just really beautiful. And I really like Ardbeg as well. I really like that. So it's really smoky, really rich kind of style as well. That's a good wake-up whiskey.
The last part is five quick-fire questions about food. So if you tell me the first thing that comes into your head, okay?
Yeah.
Whenever I'm hungry, I think of?
Meat.
Comfort food for me is?
Cheese.
My favourite childhood dessert is?
Cranachan.
My food heaven is?
Chocolate.
And my food hell is?
Avocado.
Thank you very much. That's the noise of hundreds of chicks. I stopped off at Isle of Skye Free Range, also known as Vatton Farm, to see how the business was going and to hear how Glynis and Alistair came to work this croft.
Could you just tell me a little bit about your farm?
Well, I was
born here, basically, born in Portree, brought up in Skye, learnt all crofting aspects from my father, did a stint away, working away for a while, then came back and started up another business on the croft, taking it in a different direction.
What was it they were doing before, and what kind of direction have you gone in now?
Well, basically before it was just sheep cattle on the place, growing them up to what we call sort of like store sale. So they're just sold on to middleman kind of thing, and then he fattens them up again and stuff. So now we're taking the product direct from the croft to the customer. So we've cut out the middleman, making as much on the beast that we can ourselves, basically.
And do you find in the time that you've been doing this that there's a lot more interest from the consumer in that kind of knowing where everything's come from?
Yeah, actually, a couple of weekends ago we were at the Armadale Market, and we had a lot of customers there saying that they would quite happily buy the meat when they know it's from a local producer and not just randomly from anywhere in Britain. Like your supermarket, you can't really identify where it comes from. So yeah, a lot of encouragement from customers that the food that we're producing is what they want.
How do you think the sort of landscape and like where we are sort of influences or affects what it is you can and can't do here?
Well, it's only really good to grow animals on. Over the years, the weather patterns changed that we can't grow the crops. I remember as a kid here, we always had corn, we always did our own hay. Now it's struggling even to get people to do hay. Silage is the quickest, easiest option now for that sort of thing. So we've just stuck generally to having our cattle and sheep on the place to rear on and sell.
How do you find, if you find at all, that the tourism, because obviously Skye's pretty well known as a tourist spot these days, how does that affect you in any way, or does it not really matter?
Doesn't really affect us at all for the way that we work our croft. We do get the odd tourists that obviously when they come on, they have said they've come on to Skye and they want to buy local produce, so if they do a Google search, Skye Free Range comes up. So we have sold to tourists, they have come here direct to the croft, bought office, and some of them have bought a week's supply of meat if they're staying in a holiday cottage. Yes, it helps us, but generally the tourists don't really affect us.
You guys supply the Three Chimneys, so how did all that come about?
That kind of came about, we supplied them with chicken carcasses. I believe they use them for stock and stuff like that. Earlier this year, we sent an email saying that we had X amount of chicken carcasses available, and just tagged on the email, would you be interested in some lamb and some beef? And Scott came back straight away and said, yeah. So he came up, had a look around the croft, saw some of the animals and stuff, told him what we could do, and he literally went away with two back legs 2 days later or something like that. We did lamb for him later on. We've done beef for him now. He's taking more lamb off us, and hopefully in the future he'll take more beef and lamb off us as well.
You're quite far from where you're from. So are you from a farming background as well, or is this sort of...
My grandparents were farmers. I grew up in a very rural community, but I was very much a townie. Did not like animals much at all growing up. When I was on my grandparents' farm, if I could spend it with my grandma in the kitchen, I would. But came here and just, yeah, got into the crofting, learnt off Ali of how to work the sheep and the cows and stuff. And then we had got some chickens at one point, and I got some for eating and reared them and went, these are a really different flavour. And thought, I can't buy them here on Skye. And I thought, this is a little business opportunity. So I started with just a few chickens. Yeah, so that was 10 years ago. And then decided we had some good lamb, some good beef. We rear Shetland beef, Shetland cows, and they're a smaller cow. Very suited for this climate, actually, because they don't poach the ground too much and stuff. They're a bit smaller. But commercially, they're not quite so viable. We'd put one of those, done one for our own freezer, decided, yes, maybe we could sell that as well, sell a little bit of the beef. And that's how it's, yeah, sort of all come about.
And how did the chicken taste different? Is it just whatever you'd sort of reared them on, or how does that work?
The chickens taste different because they're actually about three times as old as a normal supermarket chicken. They're day-old chicks that we've got here just now. We've got them last Friday, and they're not ready till next March, whereas a normal supermarket chicken that's even barn-raised and things are about 6 weeks old when they're ready. So they've grown really quickly. So whereas ours are about 4 months old. They're outside from a month to 6 weeks old. They're scratching around in the grass. They're eating all the grubs. So they're growing a lot slower, so they're developing a lot more flavour, which is why they just taste, yeah, completely different. I've had customers say they've kind of had it for the first time, they says it's quite gamey, but actually then other customers come up to us and go, that's what I remember my grandmother giving to us when she used to go out the back of the croft and get one of her hens for dinner.
And so how did you guys meet?
I was working on the croft, I was working for a local farmer's roundabout, and then I got asked by a shearing contractor that worked down Loch Earnhead to go down and help him out. So I went down there for a few weeks, met up with a chap from New Zealand called Hugh McDade. He said to us, if you want a job in New Zealand, I'll organise you a job. So I just said, yeah, go for it. Thought, never hear anything about it. He phoned us up about 2 months later and said, right, you've got a job, you've got to be here by November. Organised people to look after the croft for us while I was away, because I was ended up away for 7 months. Flew out to New Zealand and started shearing the next day in New Zealand. And yeah, did 7 months out in New Zealand. Took a month off while I was there and travelled around the South Island as well. Just before I flew out, there was a big shearing contest in Tikiwiti. It's the main shearing contest in New Zealand. Went up there, sheared in the shearing show, went out to the pub, like you do, and yeah, met Glenys.
As you do. And then you obviously, because you've got this croft, you came here.
Yeah, I'd finished uni and things out in New Zealand. Wasn't sure what I was going to do, so decided to... It's one of the things that most Kiwis do is do their big OE to Britain anyway, so I was planning on doing that, so I came over here to see where Ali lived. And yeah, 22 years later, I'm still here. Haven't actually left. We did at one point think of selling everything and moving back out to New Zealand. But Skye, it's a great place to raise a family as well. Just a nice place to live. And we've made a life here, and we've done changes with the croft. And so we're making a living off the croft as well. Although we do both work off the croft, it's not a full-time living at the moment.
Can I just ask, the difference between a croft and a farm is it someone else owns the land of the croft, is that right?
Yeah, we're tenants to McLeod Estate, so we pay our rent every year to McLeod Estate, so as long as we pay the rent, you can't chuck us off. But this croft has been in my family for about 150 years. So my grandfather, one of my uncles, then my father ran it, and now I'm running it. And hopefully, we'll see, but our oldest daughter, she's really keen on crofting and farming and stuff like that, so she might take it on as well.
That's good.
Yeah, so goes into another generation.
And what lambs do you have? Or sheep, sorry.
Generally, they're cheviots with a touch of Texel through them. We run what they call a meat link tup, which is a tup that's been made up of 5 different breeds, and we get them index linked purely for what we want them for. So at the moment we have 2 meat link tups running with yows. One of them is index linked to produce ewe lambs for mothering ability, so any ewe lambs that he leaves should become good mothers that will keep in the flock and use to breed with. The other one is index linked just to produce fat lambs, so all the lambs from him will be sold. These lambs come up to weight for us quite quickly through the summer on the good grass, so we can start taking lambs out early on. We start lambing beginning of April with the yows, and we can have the first lot of lambs away mid-July to the abattoir to customers.
And is the abattoir nearby, or do you have to sort of ship them into...?
No, it's a 3-hour drive for us, one way. The nearest one is Munro's in Dingwall.
Is that the same for the chickens, or do you just sort of...?
Chickens we're allowed to process here on site. So the biggest mileage for the chickens is I went to Perth on Friday to collect the day olds. They're hatched down in England, so that's the biggest mileage for them. For the chicks, but no, everything else we're allowed to do on site.
And if we wanted to buy some eggs or a whole chicken, are you, is it very much how you need to come here to do that, or do you sort of send out on from online or anything?
The easiest way is to either send us an email through our website, which is just skyfreerange.co.uk, or we're also on Facebook, Sky Free Range, and most of our customers message us through that, get in direct contact, because we've not always got everything available. We can't do mail order at the moment. It's really difficult getting next day delivery off the island.
And so the last part of the podcast is a quick fire round to do with food. So I'll ask you five questions, but in between the two of you, if you just tell me the first thing that comes into your head, if that's okay.
Okay.
I'll start with you. Whenever I'm hungry, I think of
pineapple lumps. A New Zealand sweetie.
Oh, right. Comfort food for me is?
Biscuits and cheese.
My favourite childhood dessert is?
Pavlova.
My food heaven is?
All sorts, but yeah, jelly and ice cream probably.
And my food hell is?
Oysters.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome, thank you.
Thank you.
Just now, I'm joined by Kevin McKinnon of Locked on Vegan Shellfish. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Fine, thanks. So we're standing here at the pier. We're surrounded by creels. So could you just tell me, how's your day been so far? What have you been up to?
Currently washing and mending, getting this gear ready for the boys to go. Catch plenty of prawns, hopefully. The boat's actually out fishing at the minute. They won't be in until later on. So we're just here, getting things organised for them when they come in. They can get these aboard to go back out.
And have you always kind of worked as a fisherman? Have you, is it a family thing or is it something you've got into?
Yeah, my dad's had boats since I was born. And both my grandfathers fished before that, so kind of had no choice in the matter. I was going to end up doing it eventually.
Do you quite enjoy it though?
Sometimes, when the weather's fair and there's plenty going, but winters can be hard.
And is it quite a seasonal thing?
Well, we fish all year round. Certain times of year there's more of some things than others. At the minute, from August to now, we been doing quite a bit more crab than prawns, but prawns are all year. All the boats do prawns all year round, just sometimes there's more to catch than others.
And so is this a sea lock?
Yes, in fact we're only a few miles out there. You pass the head, you're into the little Minch.
You get prawns, langoustines, that kind of thing. Is that only really available in summer like this?
I've got all around the coast of the UK. West Coast of Scotland is renowned for it, right enough.
So you supply the Three Chimneys?
Yeah, I have done for a few years. They take both langoustine and crab from us.
So you're saying the West Coast is renowned for this. Is there any particular reason why the West Coast is so well known for its seafood?
What we do is keel caught, so the quality of the produce is much better compared to trawled, things like that. There's not much of a trawling fleet left on the West Coast these days, unfortunately.
What is the difference between keel caught and trawling?
Well, trawled, you tow net behind you and you're just dragging at the bottom, catching what's there. Keels, you set and leave for a period of time, and whatever happens to be out will crawl into them. It's a lot less. Trawling is more of a forced method of catching, whereas keels, there's no damage to the seabed and things. They're just left catch whatever chooses to go in, whereas trawling, you're just scooping up everything that's there in your path.
And do you eat a lot? It's a pretty stupid question, but do you eat a lot of what you catch?
Yes, you'd think you'd get sick of it after eating it from damn near birth, but no. Yeah, still eat plenty and enjoy it.
And what's the best way, would you say, to sort of enjoy this kind of seafood?
Brown crab, I especially like to do on a barbecue or open fire. Just put them in whole, dispatch them first, obviously, and then chuck them on whole. That's my favourite way of eating them. In fact, everything's done well on a barbecue. But yeah, just, it's that fresh. You can't really go wrong.
So are you normally out on the boat, or do you kind of do a mix of different things?
A bit of both. I've actually got a small boat that I fish through from May to November for wrasse, which we don't sell them to the fish farms. They use them as cleaner fish. So they clean the lice off the salmon, trout, instead of using chemical treatments like peroxide and things. So I do that through the summer months. And I've got my kids most weekends, so I can sometimes fish through the week, but mostly ashore doing these fun jobs like washing and mending creels while everyone else is out there catching.
And is it the type of thing that you can just kind of just fall in love with, and that's you, you know, because it's quite, must be quite hard in terms of, like, you see the weather and things.
Yeah, you do get hooked on it. I mean, I went offshore for years, offshore wind and oil and gas, but then I was lucky to have this to fall back on right enough. But yeah, you'd always end up back doing it. You hate it at the time. You're constantly abusing your body and aches and pains. I'm only 33, but I feel about 50-odd. But yeah, you still go back and do it.
And what a place to do it as well. I know, you, I mean, the type of place you must be used to all this, but it's an amazing landscape.
Yeah, I mean, I say, in the summer months, when the weather's nice, there probably isn't a better job, really, but the winters are long here. You get about 8 months of winter and only a couple of months of summer. It can be quite hard on the body and the head, but at the same time, it is enjoyable.
And what about tourism on Skye? Like, it's become extremely well known as a tourist destination. Is that something that affects you, or is it not really something that you need to deal with?
Not really. Not while we're at sea, but as we discussed earlier, the roads is a bit of an issue. Yeah, I mean, what the bulk of what we catch still goes to the continent. It's a very small percentage of our catch actually stays locally. Almost every business on the island relies on tourism in some way, shape or form. So it's definitely beneficial to the place as a whole.
Why is it a farm salmon in Scotland and not wild salmon?
There's very few wild salmon caught. It's just the sheer volume of salmon that's consumed. They're just not there in the wild, so they have to be farmed. And the Scottish farmed salmon goes everywhere, globally, Asia. I'd actually like to know myself what percentage stays here, because all over the Americas, North America, Asia, it's always Scottish salmon you see, and it is all farmed.
I mean, I kind of understood it's like, because there's so much salmon consumed, but you can fish wild salmon just you as a person.
You can, yeah. You can, there is. They are still there. But yeah, for the amount that's consumed, you can never catch wild. And all the rivers you can catch them, or the majority of them, are permitted. So you need to be licensed to do it.
And you're saying quite a lot of your catch goes to the continent. Nothing's really changed then with Brexit.
Made it a bit more difficult for, I mean, our buyers, we don't ship it direct. So we land twice a week to Avivier, which is then taken to Eyemouth, and from there they pack it out to the continent. So it's become quite a bit more difficult for them paperwork-wise. And there was a wee blip. I mean, the whole of January last year, when Brexit was first kind of clicked into action, we had a month where there was just no landings whatsoever. So that was a bit difficult, but everyone seems to be on top of it now, and things are flowing a bit more smoothly.
Just the final bit of the podcast is five quick fire questions, if you tell me the first thing that comes into your head. Okay, whenever I'm hungry, I think of...
I don't know. That's really stumped me. I love all food. Normally chorizo or something like that.
Comfort food for me is...
Yeah, junk, like probably pizzas and things like that. Yeah.
My favourite childhood dessert is...
Ooh, Mars bar slice that you used to get in primary school. I've not had it in years.
My food heaven is?
Probably Spanish food, any tapas, meats, seafoods, paellas. Yeah, Spanish is my go-to food.
And my food hell is?
Lamb. Absolutely hate lamb. Even the smell of it cooking, just, I can't do it. But I did, for the first time in a huge number of years, eat lamb at the Chimneys 2 weeks ago. I didn't have the heart to tell him I didn't like lamb, and Dad was, he decided to man up and eat oysters, so I thought I'd do it, and it was actually very nice.
This could be me tonight, because I'm going to have the tasting menu, and I've not told them I don't like lamb, yeah. So I'm going to take your word for it.
It was very nice, but I definitely preferred a beef or venison as the red meat course, but yeah, it was nice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guests on this episode of Scran, and thanks to you for listening. Please remember to rate, review and subscribe. Scran is a Laudable podcast that's co-produced and hosted by me, Rosalind Erskine, and co-produced, edited and mixed by Kelly Crichton.